I was going to work, and I just felt like, oh, is this it? Like, is this really all there is? Like, I feel so unfulfilled. I don't remember how I got here. I used to love drawing. Like, what happened to that? And I still love, writing. And around this time, I picked up Divergent, and like it was blowing up around this time, I think. And I remember I really liked it, so I went and I looked at who the author was, and I saw that it was a young woman in her early 20s, and that like blew my mind. I was like, wait, I don't have to be a university professor in my 60s to write and publish a book. And then I just like, I was like, oh, this is so cool. Let me research more about it. And I think around this time, there was also like the self-publishing boom that was going on. So there were a lot of podcasts about like building your author brand, build your author career, and writing craft. And like, okay, you have to write so many books and then publish them and then have your newsletter and you have all this plan. And so that like gave me a new drive. Like I was like, I came back to life almost.
What is up, everybody? You're listening to episode 65 of SFF Addicts. I'm your host, Adrian M. Gibson, and welcome to your weekly dive into the world of science fiction, fantasy, and writing craft. Joining me, as always, is my co-host, the Chewie to my Han Solo, the Joker to my Commander Shepard, MJ Kuhn. How's it going, MJ?
Hello, I'm wonderful. How are you?
Doing very well. And if you'd like to support MJ's work, you can pick up Among Thieves, her debut novel, which is full of kick-ass characters and hatchet-wielding thieves and all kinds of found family and just some raucous shit. You're gonna love it. And the sequel, by the time this episode comes out, Thick as Thieves, is also available. So go support this wonderful author. As well, a quick note for listeners, the official SFF Addicts Patreon and merch store are live, so check the links in the description to support what we do here. Also, don't forget to rate and review the podcast on your favorite podcast app and subscribe to the FanFi Addict YouTube channel, where this and every other episode of the show is available in full video. And now, welcoming today's wonderful guest, Gabriela Romero La Cruz, debut author of The Sun in the Void. Bienvenida, Gabriela. ¿Cómo estás?
Hello. I'm good. Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's an absolute pleasure. But just to get started, for anyone who isn't familiar with you, your work, can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
My name is Gabriela Romero La Cruz, but I prefer to be called Gabby. Way shorter. I'm a former chemical engineer, present time now, illustrator. I illustrate as a moonborn, and I'm also an author as of next week. Because my book, or when
as
this
of the time this episode comes out.
Currently.
As of currently, I'm an author.
Well, congratulations on that. Yeah, we've both read The Sun in the Void and absolutely
so fantastic.
Loved it,
so. Yeah, listeners, yeah, gotta pick it up if you haven't yet. But I'm curious, Gabby. So, how did you get into reading in general and like sci-fi and fantasy specifically? Like, do you remember your like fantasy sci-fi gateway drug?
Yeah. Do you want the short answer or the long answer?
Oh, let's give the full answer. Let's go.
The full answer. Oh my gosh. Yeah, so this is a little unusual, but I got into sci-fi and fantasy with fan fiction.
Nice. Love it.
And actually, so what led me to fan fiction was anime. This was when I was like 12 or 13. I lived in California briefly when I was 10, and I had like 6 months of ESL. But we had to move back to Venezuela. And I loved going online as like a way to like preserve my English, because most of the internet at this time, which is like 2002, a lot of the websites were just in English. And at the time, I was also huge into like anime. I think what was being broadcasted in where I was living in Venezuela was like Inuyasha, Shaman King, just like really old stuff, Yu Yu Hakusho.
But good stuff.
And
the classics. Yeah,
the great stuff. The great stuff that I still watch.
Inuyasha is fucking fantastic. I love that.
Oh, yeah. It's amazing. I can talk about Inuyasha all day. Don't get me started. Anyway. Okay, so the way I discovered fanfiction was because I was Googling my favorite characters from Inuyasha. And on, like, just a random Google result, there was, like, a fanfiction of Inuyasha. And that blew my mind because I didn't have much, my family didn't have much of a culture in reading. This sucks to say, but it's true. I can't recall, like, a single time when my parents, like, read a book for enjoyment. My family comes from a really poor upbringing, and books was just like some, like, we had dictionaries and, like, miscellaneous, like, history books from required reading in school at home, but, like, absolutely no fiction, and that was not really, like, a part of my life. So fan fiction is when I discovered my love for reading. I became, like, a devourer of fan fiction, and it was super accessible. You know, you just Google whatever and then it would come up. and so, like, I just had this desire, this drive to, like, contribute to the community. And I started writing. And yeah, I started writing so much fan fiction. I've been writing since I was 12. I never really stopped.
That's so cool. I love that fan fiction was your gateway into this world. Cause it's like,
yeah.
Cause
it went from, like, anime, video games, and then, yeah, like, to fan fiction. And then later on, like, I moved back to the US, or moved to the US, and then I had, you know, libraries, and the school library was great. I was very introverted because it was really hard to move here. And like, I wasn't very good with the language. I feel like there's two separate parts of the brain, like the reading and comprehension and writing is, like, one part, and then the speaking is, like, a different part. And I was, like, so self-conscious of the way I spoke and, like, pronunciation, and it's just, like, cultural shock. So I didn't really have friends. And I would just, like, go to the library during, like, lunchtime or, like, breaks. And yeah, that's where I started reading, I guess, a lot of young adult and middle grade. And sadly, I don't remember a lot of the titles that I was reading at the time. But yeah, just, like, really, it was, like, my consolation, I guess. Like, you know, like, it's the books were my friends when I was a teenager. I moved to the US in 2005. I was 14. And yeah, that my English was not great because I was just, like, surrounded in a Spanish speaking country. Like, no one spoke English around me. And I just read and wrote. So I wasn't really practicing the speaking. And yeah, I could pass the ESL tests that, you know, they give you, like, written tests. So they're like, okay, you're good to go, like, Gen Pop, like, go.
But then it's like, oh shit, I can't translate this into, like, actual spoken words.
Yeah.
Well, because it's a totally different beast. And, like, I mean, A, just because speaking with the pronunciation and stuff, but also, like, I feel like when you're reading and writing, you have the time, you can sit, you can process things a little longer, and conversation is, like, mm-hmm. real time. Like, it's
yeah.
right now.
Yeah.
So I can totally see where that would be.
Yeah. And so, like, yeah, I had to get, like, pronunciation right. And also, the grammar is different. And the way that I thought, my thoughts were in Spanish. So, like, I'm creating these sentences in my head trying to say things, or, you know, it was, like, definitely challenging. And my family's, a lot of my cousins have moved here, and I really understand, like, the difficulties they go through, you know, trying to, like, assimilate.
Yeah. Because I've kind of,
go ahead.
Well, I was going to say that later on, I really, really got into, like, epic fantasy and secondary world fantasy through video games. Like, video games were, like, a big thing. Final Fantasy games were a big thing for me. And then I discovered Game of Thrones, as a bunch of us did, I guess, in, like, 2011.
All right.
And that was the first time that I really considered, like, secondary world fantasy as like a separate thing from like contemporary fantasy. And I was like, oh, like I can escape to like a brand new world. This is not like this world, it's a different world. So yeah, I think those are like the moments that really stand out in my memories.
Yeah, I'm oh, there's so many things that I wanted to touch on. Because it's like the language.
Go
the
on,
language
thing. Yeah.
It's like I experienced it in reverse, where it's like I come to a Spanish-speaking country and I'm trying to figure out like how to assimilate and how to learn the language and everything like that. And the way that you mentioned it about like writing things, but like in your head it's in a different language and you're kind of doing this real-time translation thing. I've definitely experienced that and it's super fucking trippy.
Yeah. I remember like how old I was when I started thinking in English. I think like the switch happened around when I was like 18 and I was going to college. So for like a good like 4 years, I was living here, but I was like in all my thoughts, like, you know, what are you thinking? Oh, going to the groceries or like if you want to watch something, it's all in a different language. You know what I mean? I mean, you know
yeah.
what I mean.
Yeah.
Super trippy though. You've already touched on your writing journey though a little bit, but I'm curious, like as you got older, after you started writing your own stuff when you were 12 and just kind of continuing on with that, what compelled you to just keep going? Because you mentioned that you were a chemical engineer, but then how did you kind of like come back to it? And was The Sun in the Void the first book you've written, or were there others that ended up, you know, set aside along the way once you were more serious about doing this?
So I'll give you everything. So I adore writing, and that's what fan fiction did for me, right? But growing up, because there wasn't really a culture of reading, I didn't know any writers, I didn't know, you know, I didn't know any books when I was younger. And the books that I knew were like the required reading for school. So in my head, I always assumed that in order for you to be a writer, you were like a 50-year-old, 60-year-old university professor who is, you know, publishing like books for education, stuff like that, you know? So being a writer was never a viable career path for me at all, ever. And it was not something that I talked about it with my parents or anyone in my life. It's just something that I did like privately. Like when I was in high school, I would be like pretending I'm writing an essay in biology class, but actually I'm writing a fan fiction.
I love it.
So yeah, I was always writing. And when it came time to choose career paths, I just really wanted a career path that gave me security from poverty. And like, the idea was always like a STEM career or like a law degree or like to be a doctor. Like those are the only like things that my family would like accept as a viable career option. And it's understandable, you know, because they come from really like poor backgrounds. Like my grandparents barely finished high school, and my parents were the first to go to college, and yeah, I think they're the only ones from their siblings that have like degrees. So like having like a, like one of those careers, like stable careers, is like the only way to have a secure living. And my parents are both engineers. And so I saw that as like, okay, like engineering has led us to the US. It's like improved like our standard of living. And you know, we can afford things. So that's like what I had in my mind. And I always was drawing as well. I started drawing. I think I was inspired by Sailor Moon manga. Weird. I picked up a manga when I was living in California briefly. And also anime, it's very visual, mm-hmm. right? So I was always drawing and writing, you know, my favorite characters from Inuyasha. Yeah, so my plan was, I remember this, my plan was I was going to go to university and be an engineer, and I didn't care which one. I just remember that I was good in math and chemistry, so okay, fine, chemical engineer. And that was going to be my plan B, and I was going to be an animator. I was going to go to like get another degree and go into animation. But turns out that being a chemical engineer is quite hard. The program is intense. I went to U of H and it's a grueling program. Like they wear you down. Like it's a grind. Like you basically live in the library. My peers, we all live in the library, and I just kind of forgot about those things. I wasn't really drawing anymore, and I was like writing like here and there because it was like quick to do. But I was just so immersed in the engineering student culture that I completely forgot about my plan A of becoming an animator. And near graduation time, I just, you know, everyone was getting a job in oil and gas. I live in Houston. And so I also went and got a job in oil and gas. So, you know, just like following the progression, and chemical engineering was challenging, and I enjoy a challenge. I enjoy feeling like I'm overcoming something difficult. So that was, I think that's why I was able to stick with it for a while. And I remember when I was, I think this is like 2014, I was just like really sad. Like I was going to work and I just felt like, oh, is this it? Like, is this really all there is? Like, I feel so unfulfilled. I don't remember how I got here. I used to love drawing, like what happened to that? And I still love, you know, writing. And around this time I picked up Divergent, and like it was blowing up around this time, I think. And I remember I really liked it. So I went and I looked at who the author was, and I saw that it was a young woman in her early 20s. And that like blew my mind. I was like, wait, I don't have to be a university professor in my 60s to write and publish a book. And then I just like, I was like, oh, this is so cool. Let me research more about it. And I think around this time, there was also like the self-publishing boom that was going on. So there were a lot of podcasts about like building your author brand, build your author career, and writing craft. And like, okay, you have to write so many books and then publish them and then have your newsletter and you have all this plan. And so that like gave me a new drive. Like I was like, I came back to life almost. And I would listen to these podcasts and a bunch of audiobooks like on the way to work in my commute. I was carpooling with coworkers and I would like write on my laptop on the drive to work, you know, like when it was not my time to drive. And I was like writing during lunchtime and I was writing when I came home. Oh, yeah, because then I was like, yeah, I shouldn't write fan fiction. I should write my own book. and so I wrote a YA sci-fi that I love very much, and I like edited it a lot. But like when I was like I started querying it, and I just did like maybe like 6 queries, I think, and that's when I realized that like maybe this is not the book to publish. Like I don't feel that strongly for it. And part of me is glad that I've made that decision, because querying, as you know, is like insanely hard. So you really need to believe in the work to succeed, I think.
to survive. Yeah.
I set that aside and I decided to do something else. And like I said, I was like really into Game of Thrones, and I loved like the world that Martin created, and it was amazing. I remember like when Game of Thrones came out, I started actually writing like AU fan fiction in secondary worlds, and I was making up my own worlds, but with like characters from whatever I was writing at the time. So I was kind of like practicing a little bit with that. But so when it came time to write my second book, I decided to, how exciting would it be to write like a epic fantasy that, I've seen so many so many fantasies that are inspired by Japanese culture and Greco-Roman culture and like Western European culture. Like, how cool would it be to see, you know, the heroes of our independence, like in doing sword fights and, you know, a setting that was like 1800s Venezuela. Like, how cool would that be? And I was like really energized by that idea. And, but like, I don't feel like I achieved that exactly because mine is more, I feel like it's more indulgent. It's something to avoid and it's not quite as historical fantasy as that initial idea would have been. I don't know.
No, but after reading the book, it's like for me as someone who lives in Ecuador and understands like the history of like Gran Colombia and Simón Bolívar and people like that, I'm like, there's so many nods in there that it doesn't, I think it benefits from not being historical fiction and being more of your own thing and having, you know, nods and hints to the actual history that people who know it can pick up on and say, yeah, like, that's fucking cool, you know?
Yeah. And that's what I wanted. Like, similarly, as someone who is familiar with like American culture, like Western European culture, might see a nod to something and they understand it's not like historical fiction, historical fantasy. It's still like cool, you know? So I wanted to do that. And it was for me. I'm glad I'm really happy you see all those things, yeah. Adrian.
It's like, I'm a huge, like, I love podcasts so much. And there's this amazing podcast called Revolutions. And they did one about the whole like revolution in Northern South America, like a whole episode season, like a whole season of just that. And they go from like different places. They do like Haiti, they do different revolutions over time, but like coming to Ecuador and then listening to that podcast, I was just like mind blown and just seeing like, there's like, you know, like, Avenida de Simón Bolívar in Quito. There's like fucking streets named after all these different people. And I'm like, I know who you are now. And I understand that, that context. And it's really cool.
Yeah. Yeah. So I try to translate things to be a secondary world with the Son of the Void. Part of it because there's a lot of different stories and different pieces of folklore that are in there. I don't want to like take them and do them poorly. I want to be able to maybe in the future do a more like an adaptation that feels more true to the original stories. Or if not me, then like let other writers, you know, do a more like a truer adaptation to the stories, the histories, the folklore. Yeah, the horror stories. But for creating the Son of the Void, I just kind of like grab them and did like a spin on it, like a nod to it. Yeah.
Well, I want to dig into that a little bit more because you've talked a little bit about, you know, it being inspired by Game of Thrones and seeing these second world fantasies. And of course, you know, wanting to explore pulling in, you know, your family's culture and stuff with your second world fantasy. Where did the idea for the story come from though, in The Son and the Void? And like, how did you flesh that out? And, you know, I wanted to hear a little bit about how it grew into the awesome novel that it is.
Yeah. I feel like this is the plots. I've been working on them for so long. I don't remember exactly like the moment where they came into my mind. Cause you know, like when I was younger, I was always writing little, like I have a folder of stories that I just have cause I was a bored kid too. I didn't have a lot of things to entertain myself. So the way that I would entertain myself is being in my bedroom, just like jotting down ideas and like thinking about characters and scenarios. So I always had them saved, like special, like my special ideas, my special characters, my special plots. And they were always safe for later when I was a better writer. Like that was like what I would tell myself. And when I started writing The Son of the Void, I thought I was a better writer. Spoiler alert, I wasn't. It was a really long journey to get it to what it is now.
It definitely is. No, like for every writer.
I had no idea what I was getting into. But that's how like all those different characters and scenarios came in there. I wanted to write a little bit about unrequited love And I did that with Reina. And I wanted to like talk about privilege, and I did that with Celeste in Reina's relationship. Initially, I had this idea of the characters being like in different companies, and it's like an alliance. And sadly, I had to get rid of a bunch of characters and combine characters. So like a lot of the relationship for Enrique and Orselina was just that, like, they were supposed to be like different factions. now they're in a household. I wanted to create a sense of danger in the world. And I was inspired by Kingdom Hearts with the Heartless. Nice. And that's like kind of like what inspired the Tinieblas. Yeah. So, but I used to call them Leftovers. I had to change that because of the TV show, the HBO.
No, but Tinieblas is way cooler.
You think so?
Yeah. Because I mean, like, you know, MJ, if you translate that word from Spanish to English, it kind of means like darkness, shadow. It's kind of like a shadow creature. So it fits perfectly. Yeah. Yeah.
Ooh. Yeah.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah. It's like shadow, but like it has that connotation that's alive.
Yeah. 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 It feels very like Studio Ghibli in that sense, like shadows coming alive, like in Howl's Moving Castle or something like that. Mm-hmm. It was like, but like more monstrous and demonic and
Yeah. So that's how I came to that, because I wanted to have the sense of danger in the wilderness. And and I was hugely inspired by Studio Ghibli, by the way. I realized this later. It wasn't like a direct inspiration, but I must have been inspired somehow with Ashitaka's, like, the corruption in his arm. I think that must have inspired me, because you can very easily like draw a parallel to like Reina's heart with that. The story really clicked when I created like the plot of Reina's heart, her heart like being forced to be transplanted, and she has now like an irradio heart. I think that really elevated the story. And it wasn't like that initially when I started writing it. I don't remember how it just came. It was like an aha moment, you know, but it's like,
those are the best parts of the writing process, right? Where it's like, it clicks and it's like,
usually alone, yeah. And all you want to do is just say like, fuck yeah, and like high five someone, but yeah. There's no one to high five.
Right? High five yourself, yeah. A self-five. Yeah.
And the plots of the Damas, I know I wanted to create the scenario where like they're gathering the sacrificial brides, and it has to be for God. Like, that just came to me. That literally just came to me. And I was like, God, legend tells that God Rama would grant ascension to the person who sacrifices his 9 wives. Like, I just remember, like, I had that. It came to me and I was like, I love that. I'm keeping it. And it stuck with me. It stuck with me till the end. So it's one of the good ones. One of the good things that came to me. But I remember that I wanted to have this plot where like you have this people like the alliance, and they are searching for sacrificial brides. And like one of the members actually finds out that like the love of their life is one of them, you know, or like the, I'm also huge with like childhood friends to lovers. Like that's like my favorite trope. I don't know why writing that trope. I keep going back to it. And initially the story was that Reina and Celeste grew up together. I had to age it up because my agent suggested that like editors would want older main characters at the beginning. So they had less time to be together, but that's like what I wanted. I wanted the main character to grow up in kind of like this twisted environment where they're not the good guys, they're the villains. And you know, they're pursuing this thing, and it turns out that like that's a twist. Like now Reina has to potentially sacrifice the person that she loves the most. Wait, is this a spoiler-free podcast or... I feel like I'm spoiled so much.
Spoiler's choice.
Should we just put a spoiler tag on this?
Yeah, right. You can just redact.
No, the whole podcast is a spoiler, guys.
No, it's all good. It's all good.
Yeah.
Well, I can edit that out, or we can just say like, fuck it. And I'll just put a little spoiler and be like, mild spoilers in this episode.
I don't know how I feel about that. I think I'm cool with spoiling people. So you get, go read the book before you listen to the podcast.
There we go. Yeah. It's been out for like a couple weeks by the time this airs.
Warning, read the book first.
Yeah.
Right. They had their chance.
And I also kind of rejected the idea that the main character should be Celeste. There's so many stories where like the princess, the badass girl, who's the one being hunted, she's the main character. I mean, later on I realized, oh, it's because it's probably a more compelling story to have this be the main character. But when I started writing the book, I wanted a different main character than that point of view. And I also wanted to show kind of like the villain side, the antagonist side. And when I initially started writing The Son of the Void, Javier was the antagonist. So that's why I like kind of like where Eva came from.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
No, it's like, I really, really love the characters in this book. And yeah, you kind of brought up like, how the evolution of your writing process, like they ended up being in a household as opposed to like different factions and stuff like that. It gave me some serious like Gabriel Garcia Marquez, like 100 years of solitude kind of vibes, where it's just like the household as this kind of central force within the story. And it's like that one takes place in Colombia, but it was cool to kind of see, whether intentional or not, that you kind of created this story with some very strong family dynamics and that kind of thing. And then at the same time, like inverting a lot of expectations, especially coming from like South America, where there's this huge like machismo culture, to be like, I'm going to portray strong female characters who have more agency and more power than you would usually find.
Yeah. Well, so I actually have not read, what was it, 1,000 Years of Solitude?
100 Years of
Solitude. 100 Years. Dude, oh my God, I'm horrible.
It's very dense. It's very dense, but it's worth it. It's worth it.
You can take my citizenship, okay? I accept
it's
it.
It's fine. It's a Colombian book. Who gives a shit?
True. No, I have not read it. I have not read it. But it makes sense to me that the family drama would be a central point, because I feel like that's a core element of like Venezuelan media or like Latin American like life. Like family drama is king, you know, like in the telenovelas you have all these different characters, and you know, a lot of people come from big families. I come from a big family, and every person in the family has their own different, you know, drama they introduce into, in complication and conflict. So I think maybe that's where like it came for both of us. For me and the other author.
Yeah, it's just like cultural osmosis.
I think so.
Kind of thing. Yeah, but what about the female characters? Like for you to be putting the focus on them, like Reina and Celeste and like these different characters, to be like, you know,
I feel like this is
so much room to like play with tropes, but at the same time it's kind of like maybe it's more just personal and it kind of came from your heart kind of thing.
Yeah. Okay. So the broadcast of female characters, I think it just came natural to me. I don't know how else I would have written it, to be honest. I also grew up surrounded by a lot of women, like my mom's side, all women, my dad's side, all women. Literally only have like, we only have like 10% males in the family. Everyone else female. So I'm just used to strong women in my life. And I consider myself a strong woman as well. My mom, like my grandma, very formidable. Everybody's just really strong and scary.
Some fucking Doñas in here just like,
strong and scary. I love it. You know what? I aspire to someday be described that way, though, right?
Yeah. So I don't think I could have done it any other way. I was inspired by my family, my aunts, like Eva's side of the family. You know, there's a lot of strong women in her that are creating conflict in her life. And I was inspired by, you know, my family as well. So many aunts that are very strong. My grandma's very strong. But as far as Reina and Celeste, I was just kind of like processing my own feelings, you know? So that's where I, like I said, I wanted to write a story of unrequited love with Reina, and with her like being with not the person she expects, but someone that's much better, you know, like yep. with Mayuri.
Yeah.
Moving up in the world.
I do.
Yeah, exactly.
Girl.
Exactly. Yeah. I love that one. Yeah. The characters, they're so vivid in the story. But I think another thing that really shines in The Sun and the Void is that kind of melding with world history and the magic and the mythology that we kind of touched on a little bit earlier when you were talking about, you know, that it's inspired by the culture, but it is not, you know, a historical fantasy. I'm curious about the process that went into creating your magic system, your magical races, so the Valko and the Nozariel. I'm so sorry if I mispronounced those.
It's pretty close. And,
it was like, yeah. Yeah. Okay, good.
You just don't have like the Spanish accent, but it's all good.
Pronunciations of things a lot. Yeah. I pronounce it in my head way while I'm reading, and I'm usually wrong. but yeah, I'm just curious about how you went about creating all of that and like pulling from, you know, history and experience and your own creativity.
Oh, and the sun god and the void god.
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
Okay. So I wanted my world to have like unique races. And I was wondering, like, why does everyone do orcs and elves? Like, don't they know these are made up creatures that another writer made up?
Yeah, yeah.
Right, you can do whatever you want.
You can do whatever you want.
Don't
yeah.
have to just fucking follow in Tolkien's footsteps. You should.
I want my own creatures, okay? And I feel like it was important for me to talk about social and racial prejudice and differences in society. If it was a story set in a world inspired by South America, because we're a melting pot of cultures and peoples, so they couldn't be homogeneous. Even though I feel like Venezuelans are pretty homogeneous, but that's just culturally, it's just my opinion. But racially, it's a melting pot of races. So I wanted to create a world that had a melting pot of races as well. So I created Los Ariels and the Valkos. And I wanted them to be stronger because it just seemed like a cool idea. I think it was inspired by Final Fantasy, and in Final Fantasy games, there are different species as well. And I thought that was always cool. You know, when you're playing a tactics game and you get to choose a character that has like this race and this attribute. So that's a little bit what inspired me to have
like certain races have like better stats in certain regards.
Yes, compared to other races. Exactly. Exactly. Yeah, yeah. And I wanted that. So I wanted to make the Valko stronger and beautiful. You know, I'm definitely inspired by like that, maybe like vampire trope or like elven trope, the stronger, beautiful creature. But they also have like their own nature, like, and it's different from humans, and it's like just more vicious, more indulgent in instincts and their needs and wants.
More animalistic.
Yeah, almost. Yeah. And I just gave them antlers.
Which was a dope touch. It's it's so cool, though, right? Because it's, I mean, A, it made for sweet cover.
Yeah. And you know what? I did consider, like, man, this is a problem. Like, doorways need to be taller. Like, how does the bed work? But I was like, you know what? No, because they are also the last of their kind. Okay. So, and they have been mixing through generations because they're not as abundant as humans. So their antlers are smaller and smaller. So Enrique and Javier have Valkos. So their antlers are big, but not as huge as you would imagine. And then Celeste and Eva are quarter Valko, and their antlers are like shorter, like to here. Yeah. So that was my work around that. And I really enjoy that trope of like the last of the kind. Like, I think I was first introduced to that maybe like in Final Fantasy VII with Ares being a Cedra. And maybe the Targaryens, you know, the last of their family. Yeah. So I really enjoy that. And I think that also, I wanted to add like the parentage with Eva and her dad that way, like kind of like, miss someone mysterious. So that's how, oh yeah, and the Noserios, actually the Noserios, there was just a different species from this world. And their tale didn't actually come until last year, like it's a quite recent addition. I don't know how it just came to me, but I just thought, like, you know, we do a lot of passing, like we change the way we look to look more white all the time, to appeal more to like the Spanish look, you know, and I thought like that I could translate that to the Noserios tail, even though they're not enslaved anymore. They have been cutting off their tails for so long to pass and appear as more human. And even they also conceal their other Noserial characteristics, the scutes in the nose and their elbows and knees. And like, you know, they wear long sleeves and maybe smile less, not show the canines. So just like subtle changes. Like they look similar to humans because the humans are the majority. They modify somewhat their appearance to better fit in this majority society. And so I thought, man, like adding the tail could also work that way. And I went with it and it just like kind of fit that Reina's dad would be an idealistic person and he would say, okay, like, you know, we are a new nation, free, like newly freed, and Noserios are equal to humans in his perception. And my daughter who has a tail, she's not going to be cut off. She's going to be a proud Noserios, you know, and, you know, he's not in her life anymore. And Reina resents her difference because she, you know, she gets bullied for the tail a lot. So that was a later addition, and I thought it was like an interesting like allegory to like a lot of the things we do to pass.
I think it was a really nice touch because it was like the way that there's the stigma between people who cut it off, or it's more like the parents choose to cut off their children's tails.
Yes.
More so.
Yes.
And it's kind of like, you know, I mean, it's not like a great visual, but it kind of reminds me of like how circumcision is played out in different cultures, or also like castration of women and different things like that.
Yeah.
But also like you were saying, like here in South America, there's this big kind of division in terms of like skin color, where it's like you have people who are more pale and more sort of like replicable of what Spaniards look like.
Yeah.
But then you have like Afro-Caribbean and you have indigenous people, and then you have mestizos, like people who are like mixed race, and everything just becomes so jumbled up there. Mm-hmm. So I thought you played with that really, really well throughout the whole book.
Yeah. And it's kind of like part of South American society, this colorism, where like you might be born lighter and you automatically have like an easier time with people just because of your external appearance. And I wanted to play with being mixed race with my characters because I'm mixed race and I experienced that growing up with my mom's side. She's from the Indies and she has more European look, although I have no idea where my family's from, by the way. Like,
it's the same with my wife's family. Like, it's like two generations ago and we don't know.
No clue. I know up to my great grandma on my mom's side. I know up to my grandma on my dad's side. And beyond that, I have no idea. Just records weren't that well kept back then. And, you know, like very humble upbringing. So they didn't really have like the priority to keep track of that. Although I do know that my grandma's uncle, he had 48 children. I remember that. I remember that because I made a story on my Instagram about it. Because the moment I found out, obviously with different women everywhere.
Yeah, like, no single woman would be able to sustain 48
children. Guys.
Oh my God! Well, you know, she'd have to be pregnant for 50 years straight for that, right?
Yeah. Like, it's like your window's not that long.
No, right? Yeah, right.
Oh, right. Oh my God!
Holy shit.
Yes, a lot of stuff like that in our family. Anyway, where were we?
Magic. How about the magic system and like the magical gods? I mean, the book is named The Sun and the Void, so it's named after like the sun god and then the void god. Mm-hmm. How did you kind of bring these elements into it?
I wanted the god, the void god, to be tied to the sacrifice of the brides. And so he already had to be perceived as like a dark entity. So I wanted to create like the opposite of that. And the sun, like light, the god of light, the god of creation, that's how it came to me. So that's why I created, you know, I created Ramagut first, and then Chess was his like rival, his ancient rival, the one that opposes his darkness. So that's how it came. And actually, that was like those opposing gods was an idea, one of my precious ideas that I had previously that I just like put in.
One of the special ideas.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and for the magic system, I was started writing The Son of the Void, I actually had just read Mistborn, and I was really inspired by Sanderson, and I was listening to his lectures on writing, you know, because I wanted to be a pro writer as well. So I was devouring his lectures. I was into writing excuses, and he was always talking about like magic system, and I was just thinking like, write what you know. I'm a chemical engineer. How can I use what I know in my fantasy book? I went into it like taking elements from the periodic table, like earth metals. That's where the Himansa metals came from. I wanted to have like these metals that were naturally found on earth and could be extracted for the magic system. But, and I also wanted to have iridium, which is not naturally found in earth, so that it could be like this additional earth metal, or not earth metal, the additional metal that was involved in the magic system. And it's rare.
Isn't there an actual element called iridium though?
Yeah. Yeah.
And is that?
That is the inspiration for iridium.
Okay. And that one is mostly found on celestial objects. Yeah. Like a meteor crashes on earth, and then that's where iridium would be found.
Yes. So that was the inspiration for iridium. Nice. And that's how they have iridium, because the meteor hit the earth, and that's where the mines are at.
Fuck yeah, science.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So cool. Yeah.
and I think I talked about this in the book, but like the meteor hit this world so long ago that it is buried, and you have to access it through mines. And I had to like, I think I mentioned that in there, but it just makes sense to me. Like it wouldn't be in the surface, you know, it would be like deep in the earth because it's been covered by sediment and
hundreds of years.
Millennia. Yeah. So yeah. And lithium was lithium, and gallium was gallium, and bismuth was bismuth. Yeah. So these are like naturally occurring.
That's so cool that you brought that chemical engineering stuff in though, because here's the thing. Are you ready? I have never even taken a single chemistry class in my entire life. I managed to avoid it in high school.
How?
And then never touched
it. Isn't it like, isn't it required?
A tricksy little hobbit, Adrian.
No, you're a tricksy dragon. Don't fucking
I'm a tricksy dragon. There you go. Oh, yeah. So I didn't know any of that. And it's fascinating for me to learn that, you know what I mean? That there's that kind of connection too.
I am also like not being fair to my chemical engineering peers, because there's not a lot of chemical engineering in this story at all.
No. But it's
for sure.
Me like, just mentioning,
again, it's
like,
point.
Me just yeah, mentioning yeah. like some elements from the periodic table. Chemical engineering.
No, but it's like the history thing. It's like there are nods to it, and if people pick it up, because it was like I was thinking about it. It was like iridium makes sense. And then you mentioned like comets, and I was like, okay, like this is all starting to click.
Uh-huh.
And then just like speaking it out loud to you, I was like, fuck yeah, like that was actually
that's my inspiration. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So but cool. I love how you've been able to combine so many different elements of your passions into this book. Like not only, you know, your love for video games and anime, you know, your fan fiction background, all that kind of stuff, chemical engineering, but also you mentioned it earlier on, but it's like your history with visual art, and you are an amazing visual artist. And I really love the style that you've developed, and the cool
gorgeous,
kind of like kawaii, kind of vibe that you have with like all of your merch and things like that. Do you want to touch a little bit more on how that progressed in terms of you being in engineering school and then kind of coming out of it and realizing that I should get back into the things that made me happy, whether it's like writing or whether it's art and that kind of stuff, but also the way that you were able to combine your artistic skill in The Sun and the Void in the form of like the chapter headings, you have like full page art for different parts of the book. And like you, I don't know if you designed like the pins and the merch and stuff for the book as well. Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
They're so Thank beautiful.
You. Yeah.
Thank you. So I never officially quit drawing or writing. You know, there were periods of time where I wouldn't do it, but I was always, you know, like sketching here and there, writing here and there. So even in those periods of time when I was too busy, I could always sneak in those two because I just love them. I just love drawing so much. I love writing so much. And for a time, yeah. So in 2016, I think like the oil and gas market like just went and we were laid off, and I was laid off from my engineering job for 6 months, but I had unemployment insurance. So I was like, oh, this is a time that I'm going to use to write my book. And, in the downtime of writing my book, I was also like trying to teach myself how to be a better artist. So I never like let go of that, like, self-taught like mentality with my art. I was always like experimenting with new things. And then I had to find a new job eventually. But I was trying to introduce my art into the Houston art scene a little more. And I would make pieces for different like gallery showings that would happen around town. So I was doing that for a little bit, and I wouldn't say it was super successful. It was kind of like a rough journey, discovering an art style that was marketable, but also I was improving, you know, and I was in that point where like my skills were not as good as I thought they were, I guess, you know, I think, you know, creatives usually have that at some point. So I wasn't doing great, but I actually started doing enamel pins. Just I was at a convention. I used to do conventions every year, and I would bring my prints and a bunch of art. But I decided to do an enamel pin. Like, I saw someone doing an enamel pin, and I decided to do one. I did like 4 designs, and they were really popular online. And I think I just kind of like arrived at a point in time where enamel pins were just like blowing up on Instagram. And I very quickly like found a very supportive community to just kind of like grow my art style. And that's how it happened. Like, I think it was 2018. Yeah. That I was just like posting and sharing. And then I opened an Etsy store and I started doing stickers and enamel pins. I did Kickstarters for a while. Those went well. I was always surprised at like how people were so supportive of the designs that I was launching. So in that regard, it has not been a struggle. Ever since I started doing the enamel pins and I kind of like officially launched the Moonborn, it has been a very like natural progression. I haven't encountered like that much resistance. And I can tell the resistance because I experienced it prior to that, and I experienced it with writing.
Exactly. Yeah.
Right.
So that was like a very natural progression. And I opened a Patreon in 2020, and that really motivated me to just kind of like just get better at being an artist. I just have this drive to just get better and better. Like, I don't know, I go online and I'm like, I see beautiful art and I'm like, oh my God, I want to do that. I want to be that way.
That's how it was for me too with tattooing, where I was just like learning DIY, tattooing myself, and then just like progressively getting better and finding my art style and figuring out like, how the fuck do I do this? And watching tons of YouTube videos and eventually getting to this point where I'm like confident to, you know, tattoo other people and start building a client base and all this kind of stuff. And then seeing tattoos on Instagram and being like, that's fucking awesome. Like, I want to experiment a little bit with my style to kind of see how I could maybe pull off something similar to that. And it's just constant, like, evolution kind of thing.
Yeah. It's just the love for the craft that drives us. Mm-hmm. And like, sometimes you're inspired and you create something awesome. And then you keep chasing that until you're inspired again and you create something else that's awesome. and I never really illustrated for the Son of the Void. I've always had this disconnect in art styles. I feel like the Son of the Void is quite dark and has a different, completely different tone to my illustration style, which is more whimsical and romantic. Maybe the Son of the Void has some of that romantic style, perhaps celestial romantic style that I try to employ in my illustrations, but I don't know, it's just different style. And I always struggled to illustrate the characters and scenarios. But I don't know, last year I just had more confidence as an artist and I went for it. And I was really happy with the results. And I just kept going, you know? And I've been making enamel pins since 2018. Yes. So I just have experience with like composition of them and how they should look and like what methods I can use, like different techniques to make different things within the enamel pin, how, you know, the production of it. And like, once you know, like, the end result and how it's going to look, then you have a better idea of how you should plan it. So like, I feel like my merch that I made for the Son of the Void has benefited a lot from that experience that I have running the Moonborn.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, for sure. Well, and speaking of being able to see the process all the way through and having that, you know, influence and make it, you know, clearer for the next time around, I'm curious, what are you working on? How are things going with your next project? You know, can you just tell us a little bit about what's next for you?
Yeah, I'm working on the sequel. I think it's going to be a lighter tone than The Son of the Void. And I can play around with that duality because there's a lot of you know, that theme of duality is ever present. In my work. So it's just going to continue on with the second book. It's going to be lighter, and I'm having a really good time putting it together. It feels less of a struggle because I have so much more experience, and I am still struggling with overwriting. I'm an overwriter and overplotter. I have so much in my outline that I'm not going to be able to touch. Like, I'm already at 80,000 words, and it's like barely hitting the midpoint.
Yeah. Ooh, she gonna be chunky, book two.
No, I have to go back.
Book one is already pretty chunky.
I have to get better at this. You know, I have to get better at.
That's what editing and revision.
Yeah, I was gonna say that's what draft two is for. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's gonna be. I'm really enjoying the romantic arcs of my characters, and it's gonna be spicier, like very spicy. I apologize to the narrator of my audiobook. If she's not into that, I hope she's okay with it. I have this in my mind because I received the audiobook yesterday, and I've been listening to it and just like so happy to hear her like bring my characters to life. And it just dawned on me like, oh crap, like, she's gonna have to narrate spicy scenes. Oops.
Oh my god.
Yeah.
Just
I am sure they're
shit.
Not a stranger to it. I feel like there's, you know,
right? Yeah,
it'll be great. Yeah.
I'm sure for narrators it's actually kind of fun to do stuff like that.
Yeah, right.
Imagine all the people who narrate romantic like stuff and erotica.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I have seen so many narrators on TikTok who just have a blast narrating, you know, spicy scenes.
Yeah, just bring the spice. I'm all for it.
Right.
It's like, yeah. I've been in Ecuador for like almost 7 years. It's like I'm all about the spice these days.
Is the cuisine spicy in Ecuador?
It depends how you like it. It's like there's a sauce called ají, which is made with chilies, and it's like that's just like throw it on the table. Whoever the fuck wants it, like, you go for it kind of thing. So it's kind of like more spice as you like it, as opposed to like a more like each plate actually has like such and such amount of spice to it. It's like each plate works with a little bit of spice, but it's like,
is that like pickled peppers?
Not necessarily. It's like a little bit pickled, but you can make like different kinds of ají from different parts of the country. So it's like, you know, the coast is different from the Andes and stuff like that. But yeah. So it's like spices you like is kind of how I describe it. Yeah. All right. Well, Gabby, to close out, I got two requests from you. Can you give listeners and viewers a good piece of soundbite writing advice, and B, tell us a weird or random fact that you find to be utterly fascinating?
Okay. The first one is easy. The second one is not easy. the first one, no brainer for me to tell this, but to anyone who's writing, just like keep going and don't give up. Like, just keep creating. There's a lot of resistance in the process, and the only way to get better is if you continue. A lot of people are like, oh, you're so talented. No, I have been doing this since I was 12. I've been drawing since I was 12. Okay. So I have decades on this. So for anybody who's doing it, you know, keep adding your decades and you'll be amazing.
I love that. Yeah.
Get your hours in, work your ass off, grind. It's all a grind. Yeah. Now give us some weird shit. Gosh. What's a weird or random fact?
I'm drawing a blank.
I know, this one's always hard. What about like a random chemistry fact?
Nah.
As I'm just trying to give you some direction, because I do feel like it's a mean question when we ask it, because people are like, there's so many ways I could go with this. Like,
okay. Fun fact. In Venezuela, there's a musical genre. It's like a little festivity. And one of the instruments is a flute made out of a deer skull. And it looks super cool. The celebration is called Ritual de las Turas. And I think it's a celebration for like harvest. But it's like a deer like skull, the instrument that they like blow into it. So it's just cool.
That is cool.
That is super badass. I really like it. The first thing that came to my mind was like when we talked to Genevieve Gornicek, and it was like, that sounds metal as fuck.
That's what I was going to say. Her fun fact was also pretty metal. Yeah, I love it.
All right, beautiful. Well, Gabby, thank you so much for hanging out with MJ and I, as well for anyone who contributes to our Patreon at $10 more a month. There will be a reading by Gabriella from The Sun and the Void, so go check that out. Gabby, can you let folks know where they can find you on social media?
Yeah, on Instagram, I am at Gabriela Romero La Cruz. And on Twitter, I think I'm G Romero La Cruz. And on TikTok, I'm also Gabriela Romero La Cruz. But I'm also the Moonborn everywhere. And I'm definitely like friendlier as a Moonborn and just like.
Back to duality.
Your alter ego.
I prefer to be a writer in private, you know, like, and an artist, like I'm more friendly and chattier. So.
Yeah. Just let me like brood when I want.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. I'm such an emo writer.
I fucking love it. Brilliant. You can also follow SFF Addicts on Instagram, Twitter, and Threads at SFF Addicts Pod, or you can follow me at Adrian M. Gibson. MJ, what about you?
Yeah, you can find me across pretty much all the socials at MJ Kuhn Books, all one word.
And go pick up Among Thieves there.
Yeah.
And Thick as Thieves, because they're both out and it's a complete duology. And
binge read it. Binge read it. The whole thing's like 600 pages. Read it in a weekend.
You got this. All right. Well, that's it for this episode. Stay tuned for next week's part two with Gabriella to hear our mini masterclass on real cultures as inspiration. Now, keep reading, keep imagining, and we'll see you next time on SFF Addicts.